From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with at least 30 million people in the United States. That is the estimated number of people who live with an eating disorder. A big misconception about eating disorders is that they primarily affect affluent, white, teenage girls. In reality, these so-called diseases of disconnection do not discriminate based on age, class, race, gender, sexual orientation. They affect everyone. The National Eating Disorders Association has launched a new campaign called Come As You Are. The goal is to promote body acceptance and validate stories of recovery. That's our goal on this program as well, as we learn about the latest research on eating disorders and methods to treat them. Only 1 in 10 people diagnosed with an eating disorder seeks treatment. And our guests hope that by raising awareness and sharing their own stories, they can eliminate the stigma associated with these disorders and encourage people who suffer in silence to speak out. Let me say hello to our guest this hour. Mary Tantillo is the director of the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders, and that is through the University of Rochester School of Nursing. And among other things, Mary's long, long list of things is she's the founder of the Healing Connection as well, and they've helped so many people. So thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
It's an important conversation this hour. And hello as well to Jennifer Slack, school psychologist and a mother who is in recovery from an eating disorder. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Christopher Fama is a graduate student also in recovery. Christopher, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And Marissa Greer is a student at MCC who is also in recovery. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, you know, Mary, I mentioned off the top here, a little bit of media honesty here, if we can self-reflect. There's two stories, there's two sort of ongoing stories in particular that almost always, if they're in the media, it is, you know, a wealthy, affluent white girl
or young woman
that's abducted people and people with eating disorders. And unfortunately, you know, those are stories that go way across boundaries. But we do sort of have this narrow gaze on it sometimes, don't we? Especially when it comes to eating disorders.
Absolutely. And I brought my friends today to help kind of bust some myths about that. People have this idea, as you said, that eating disorders happen to younger people. They actually happen across the developmental spectrum. And Jen is here. She can comment on that. So, for example, wherever there's transitions where kind of genes and environmental stress come together during that transition, for example, puberty, the switch from high school to college, and then midlife and beyond. When different transitions are happening both physiologically and environmentally, socially, relationally, those things can come together in people who are vulnerable, who have genetic risk. And so, as you can tell, this is across our whole development, and it doesn't matter what socioeconomic class you are, what sexuality you are, what gender you are. It really does not have one face, which is why NEDA, the National Eating Disorder Association, chose Come As You Are for this year to really start busting those myths. And men. Chris is here today. This is why we've assembled our cast of characters the way we have.
Okay. And it's referred to as a disease of disconnection. What does that mean?
So the goal of an eating disorder is to disconnect the person who's struggling from themselves, from their own genuine thoughts, feelings, needs, dreams, aspirations. And it does this in several different ways. There's biological, psychological, social, relational factors. Even like inside the brain, there may be disconnections with how the brain is helping you or not interpret information. So those disconnections can happen on the brain level. They certainly happen interpersonally, especially once you get sick. You're not yourself. You're not interpreting things the way you normally would, experiencing things the way you normally would. And so then your relationships with others get disrupted. And all of that is working to the advantage of the illness, which wants to isolate you. Isolation is one of the biggest things that happens when people are sick with eating disorders.
I think it'll be instructive to hear the individual stories. Not, again, in an exploitive way, but to say, look how many of us there are, and look how it does cross into, you know, all these different, however we categorize ourselves. I think the one that may surprise listeners the most is age. There is a perception that an eating disorder is a young person's thing, almost exclusively.
And it is true that if you looked at the median age of adolescence, you'd see like between 12 and 14, and you would see that the biggest bolus of people, probably late adolescence, middle adolescence, all the way to like 30-ish, are probably where lots of people are. But I can tell you, sadly, eating disorders are alive and well in younger children, shockingly, and also in those of us who are aging, and I'm including myself in that group now.
Well, let's hit a couple of points here. If you're willing to share it, what's the youngest you've seen in terms of eating disorder?
8 years old. And I actually had a five-year-old walk up to me. She was not diagnosed, but she walked up to me when she was five, and it was Halloween. This broke my heart. And she said to me, "Mary, do I look fat in this costume? I thought I was going to die." And of course, I was like, "You are smart. You are beautiful. That's a perfect costume for you. It reflects your personality. You're so strong and creative and intelligent." But that broke my heart. So our kids are they're tortured by our weight-obsessed, obesity-stigmatizing culture. And if you look at the most robust predictor for eating disorders, it is body dissatisfaction and weight concern for boys and girls is a huge risk factor. And look at our culture. And look at what kids are exposed to every day. So there's actually lots of people who walk around with what I would think of as sub-threshold eating disorders. They haven't reached the magnitude where they would receive a diagnosis, but they're not well. And how they're thinking about themselves and their bodies and who they are in the world, it creates lots of pain and suffering.
I mean, 8 years old as an actual diagnosis is shocking. That mm-hmm. must be someone who is absorbing a lot of
yes.
what they're seeing and hearing either in media or around the people around them.
Well, and also, you know, eating disorders run in families. So you may have genetic vulnerability, anxiety, mm-hmm. perfectionism, a lot of the temperamental traits that often can put you at greater risk. And then you have environmental stressors. Lots of things that happen at puberty or even when we're going to college, like, you know, who we are as people, who we hang out with, what's going on in the culture around us. You know, things that we would think of as normal developmental stressors can be very stressful for someone who is anxious or even impulsive. It's hard to slow down sometimes, not just to take things in. And those kids and young adults are probably going to have a tougher time with things that we assume would be just straightforward, right? Because there's lots of uncertainty and unpredictability growing up.
Okay. Well, I think it'll be helpful to kind of hear the stories. And let me turn to Jennifer Slack, who's a school psychologist, a mom. You're in recovery now. So to state the obvious to all of our guests here, I want you to share your story as comfortably as you want to. But I don't – any question can be shut down at any time. You know, I mean, I do want to understand what you've gone through, but don't let me push too far. So
sure.
Those are sort of the ground rules. This is your show today.
Sure.
Jennifer, when did it start with you?
It started with me right around the age of 17, just before I turned 17. I was in high school, and Mary so well articulates how eating disorders can develop. I think there was, for me, probably a genetic predisposition, being a little bit anxious, being somewhat perfectionistic, trying to be high achiever, and then there was a trigger. And the trigger might have been something that many kids could have coped with. I couldn't. And I turned it inward. And I developed anorexia nervosa. And I got some help at that time. There wasn't a lot of time. I left for college about a year after. And probably pursued recovery some years after college. But I didn't really pursue active recovery until I was about 29 years old. I would say that I've been in recovery since that time. I'm 49 years old now. I think for me, it's managing symptoms. I do believe that recovery is defined a bit differently by a lot of different individuals who struggle with eating disorders. I think for me, the main thing is managing symptoms, especially at times of stress. Or as Mary said, I've been through a lot of those different developmental moments in life. Being a teenager, being a young adult, being pregnant, entering middle age. So across the gamut, I would say there's different times where I've coped with this illness better than others.
Do you have a better sense for how to deal with it as you get older?
I do, with a lot of help. I think for me, it's been... There are many factors that have sustained recovery for me. One of the biggest has been trying to find my own voice. As Mary said, it's disconnecting from yourself. You don't really feel or experience things the way you might if you were healthy. And for me, one of the things was learning to know what I truly was feeling about things, but then express it, have a voice, not let the eating disorder be the voice.
What... If you don't mind me just trying to understand sort of the mentality that might have those moments where you feel more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a commonality? Is there a feeling that, is it about self-image? Is it about outside stressors? Is it something else?
Yeah, it's tricky to understand. People that have been with me my whole life still struggle to understand it. For me, it's not an outward thing. It's not about weight. It's not about how I appear externally. That doesn't preclude it from being influenced by our society, our culture. Mary and I were just talking outside before the program, you know, this female fixation on thinness, which doesn't necessarily exclude men, but, you know, those societal factors that keep pushing people to have this outward appearance may influence it. For me, it's much more about when I feel out of control, if I feel situations are out of control, if I'm not sure how to handle something, if I'm uncertain, if something's requiring me to have a pretty intense emotional response and I don't know how that's going to go. Maybe a specific example would be letting someone know I'm angry with them. That was something that I was never able to do. And my eating disorder sort of allowed for me not to have to. Now that I can do that, that helps prevent me from slipping back into those moments of vulnerability with it.
But help me understand that a little bit. When you say your eating disorder prevented you from having to, you would slip back into anorexia at that time?
For me, I would slip back into restriction.
Restriction.
And what I found, and I think for people that struggle with anorexia, I can't speak for some of the other eating disorders, although there are common elements through all of them. When I would slip below, for example, a certain either weight threshold or nutritional input, my brain chemistry changed. As Mary talked about before, I became more isolated. And one of the main words that comes to mind is numb. I think when you're starving, there's not a lot of energy left to put towards how you actually feel. So this numb place became more comfortable. It was more familiar, certainly, than having to go out and deal with all of the things that the world throws at you.
What does it physically feel like? I mean, you feel it, right? You have to feel it.
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer. If you ask people that are starving, they may not be able to tell you that they're starving or that they're hungry. There is also this very incredibly difficult to understand energy that can come with being underweight. At the same time, you're also incredibly fatigued, and there's not a lot of energy really left for other things. I think what I noticed physically is that my my tolerance or my ability to fight off illness, that for me personally becomes one of the biggest things that will tell me, oh, I'm not in a good place. I'm kind of sliding down this slippery slope. And along with my supporters, including Mary, who are there to sort of say, hey, you're pushing it here.
So now what's the game plan that you have going forward in managing and staying in recovery?
There are a couple really important things that I think in general help people stay in recovery. First of all, you have to be incredibly vigilant about your recovery. And for me, that means that I have to stay connected with a therapist. In my case, that's Mary. And who does a very good job of keeping me in line. And I said that nicely, didn't I, Mary?
You do it. You're the one that does the hard work.
You know, I think meal planning is something that's really important. I have to remind myself that for me, food is medicine. I have to eat. I try to keep in touch with my own emotions. I think a lot of people use journaling. I talk to my partner. I talk to my good friends. Those are things that are that I have to do moving forward. As far as my game plan, it is to do those things, to try to be aware of when I'm slipping into a lapse and jump right back on. If I don't jump right back on, I know where it can go. Whether I want it to or not, I know where it can go. It's an illness, you know, so there are times that you reach a point where it's no longer in your control. So my goal is to stay in control of it as opposed to letting it take control of me.
And I have a sort of a mental construction that might be misguided, so help me with this too.
Sure.
It's this idea that, well, you know, you're in recovery, there may be triggers or things that could kind of push you back into in that direction. But when you're generally in recovery, you know, on good days, good weeks, good months, you know, sort of food is, for lack of a better word, normal to you. Is it that way? And it only becomes something that is food is medicine, I need to kind of be vigilant about this, when you're triggered, or is it always a challenge in some regard?
That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And I bet you that you could ask 10 people and get 10 different answers. I know there are people that feel that they have reached a place where there is a comfort around it. I would say I'm sort of in the middle. I think that there's always a component of emotionality attached to it. But when I'm well in recovery, there's less of that. But yeah, I think that's a difficult question to answer. I think it's individual.
And another individual case, and I think all of our guests can weigh in on this because this is so important. People who love you, your friends, your loved ones, your family, they don't want to see you hurt with this. Mm-hmm. For people who don't have an eating disorder, stereotypically, one of the fallbacks is, well, just eat.
You know?
And I suspect everyone, just about everyone with an eating disorder might have been told that at some point, even by really well-meaning people.
Absolutely.
What do you want to say to loved ones who don't want to see you hurt or don't want to see anyone? Maybe they have a loved one. There may be people listening right now know someone, and they've said, just eat. I'm going to take you out to eat. Let's eat. You know, what's more helpful?
Yeah, because that's not what I want to say to someone when they say that to me. I'm not going to say on the radio, but it's not helpful. What I've learned to say instead is let them know what I do need at the time, which is I love you, I support you, I'm concerned. I think often even drawing attention less to the weight and the food is changes in demeanor. What I've seen in their, you know, what I've noticed in your relationships, you seem like you're spending more time alone. I'm worried. Let's go try to explore this. I think that because again, eating disorders aren't really about food. So challenging people just on food alone is not going to take them anywhere near the place they need to go for help.
That's so hard for people who don't have any eating disorder.
Oh my goodness, of course it is.
And I don't say that flippantly.
No.
That must be one of the biggest disconnects, Mary, is that the people think that they're helping in that.
Well, Jen's provided a great avenue. So what I would encourage people to do, not only patients but families, is go upstream. So if Jen is sitting having a tough time at a meal, sure, you can make a plan ahead of time about how to support the person at the table. That's very important. But more importantly, what she just said is if you go upstream, it's important to ask what went on in your day today or what's been going on recently. Because when you go upstream, it's usually anxiety about something or fear about something. And so you have to get that whole behavioral chain kind of figured out. And if the patient knew it, they would say it. So they're trying to figure it out themselves, too. Yeah. It's not that they're holding it back from you. They actually get so overwhelmed with emotion that it's hard for them to see it. So asking, like, what's gone on with your day and trying to get upstream on what happened before this moment is super important.
Well, and Mary, like, I know that we're talking about today, you know, the theme is come as you are. And I know one of the reasons that Mary asked me to be here is my age and where I'm at in life. And I think when you're talking to people that you're concerned with, you also have to take into account where they are in life.
Exactly.
You know, I look around me and I do see there are many women my age or, you know, within this span of development that I see either struggling with an eating disorder or, as Mary said earlier, sort of at that sub-threshold for a formal diagnosis. And I think how I might approach that person versus a 12-year-old could be really different too.
Yep.
And if I may butt in, going into your question about how what to say to those people, I think it's important to inform your loved ones that we don't start off knowing either a lot of times. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we actually do think it's about food because that's what we use to cope with things. So at first it's like, yeah, well, I just, like, don't want to eat, and it is about food. And then the more that you get familiar with your illness and the more you get familiar with yourself, which is hard to do in this mindset of when you're in the midst of this disorder, you realize that it's really not about food at all. And that's really hard for not only your loved ones to understand, but it's even harder for us to understand because we're the ones who are going through it and we're supposed to know. We're supposed to be able to tell ourselves exactly what's going on. And that's like one of the biggest things with me is that I tell my, like, I always know the answer to things that I'm going through. I figure out the answer. I overanalyze it. And if we don't know what we're going through, it's harder for us. So when people throw out, oh, just eat, it's even harder for us because we will then convince ourselves like the wrong things about this disorder to help.
This reminds me of group just quickly yesterday where I was sitting with a lot of adolescents who are brilliant, by the way, and they were wanted to talk about their relationship with food, and they were saying there's a lot of negativity and negative judgment. If I eat before everybody else, if I finish before everyone else, if I eat more than it, and so then I said, okay, use this as a metaphor. Where else in your life have you felt this negative judgment in addition to being at the table? A metaphor. And they all were able to say, with our peers, with school and sports. And so we went upstream. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what you have to teach parents and partners and siblings to do. It's that, but like you said, you get blinded because the illness only wants you to focus on what's in front of you at the table. I don't know if Chris might have a comment about that.
Let's explore both Marissa and Chris's story after our only break of the hour. So if you're just joining us, we're talking about not only eating disorders, but also kind of getting away from the stereotype that an eating disorder automatically means, you know, a white 17-year-old or whatever the image you have in your mind, a teenager, usually an affluent white young girl or young woman. It's 30 million people in this country at least. And most people, the vast majority, 90% or so, don't seek any treatment for it. And it crosses all kinds of boundaries. So that's what we're talking about this hour. Let's get that break and we'll come back and we're going to hear Marissa and Chris' story next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we sit down with Tabassum Javed, the president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, his first in-studio conversation with us. In our second hour, wine writer Joe Roberts joins us. He says the wine industry has lost young adults, and because of that, it is in trouble. We'll also talk to Finger Lakes winemakers to see if they agree and how they view the challenge of getting wine onto consumers' tables. Talk with you Monday. Welcome back to Connections. Just powerful stories being shared this hour about eating disorders. And you heard Marissa Greer, a student at MCC who is in recovery, beginning to kind of share some of her thoughts there. You're 21 years old now?
Yes.
And your first diagnosis, I'm reading, came at about, what, 13 to 15? So take me through what happened.
So I started realizing that I had an issue around 13. I didn't seek treatment for it until I was like late 14,
15. But you knew at 13 there was something up?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I struggled with depression before that. I've struggled with depression for as long as I can remember. And I think that's where the eating disorder kind of spurred from. And then the more that I struggled with that, the more that the eating disorder had come out and kind of taking control of me in a different way that my depression did. So I definitely had parents that didn't know much about eating disorders, and they also had the predispositions about the eating disorders that it only happens to people who are seeking attention or who are severely underweight or like things like that, that are just like it's just an attention seeking disorder, which they then thanks to Mary had smashed those myths, and then I was able to recover after that. But that is when I started seeking treatment, was when my parents started to understand, and I started to understand it more myself because they helped me realize that it's a problem and that they see it as a problem as well, which was huge for my recovery.
You know, so you're 13, you notice there's something happening, and was it a case of you know, sort of pouring your depression or low points into food or your relationship with food? Is that how it manifested?
Yeah, it was started to be relationship with food. My depression was very different. It was more my relationship with myself. So anything that it could take control of for me, it did. So I lost friends. I lost motivation for school. I stopped going to school. I started failing classes. I was 13 years old. I lost motivation for pretty much everything. And after that, it just kind of spilled into eating, which it never had before. I never experienced that. I never in my whole life thought that I would have a problem with food. I loved food. So it was very eye-opening for me that, oh, something's wrong here because I love food and I don't want to eat. And it was very hard for me to go into the depths of that and figure out that there was another thing mm-hmm. on my plate that I had to work on.
But when you say you don't want to eat, I mean, did that extend for multiple, what we would assume multiple meals or even days? Did you hide from others that you weren't eating?
Yeah, so I I was never the stereotype of someone who had an eating disorder, so it was very easy for me to go under the radar for so long. And even some of my family members, they didn't believe it was real until there was actually medical evidence that this is not okay. I was never severely underweight. I didn't go through that kind of stuff. But after a long time of going under the radar, things started to show up because after years of these habits, it starts to affect your health, which is hard, was hard for me to go through as I was an athlete and I loved to run, I loved to exercise, and it took that over too, and it took the love away from it and started making it more of a chore, and you have to do this every day in order to feel okay.
How did it impact your running and your athletics? Just lower energy, or what was happening?
No, I actually didn't stop. I increased. It was, which I didn't have the energy to do. It was very dangerous at the point, and it was hard for me to let go of that, so I used it more in a worse way for, like, everything that I was going through. It just amplified everything, and I just didn't have any energy to do anything else after, like Jen said, you don't have much energy at all. And then you pick and choose what you put your energy into, and I put it into that, and that was it.
What was it that finally started to turn things for you?
I think that after I was in treatment for my depression, and I still hadn't admitted to myself that it was a problem, that my eating disorder was a problem, because my depression kind of took over everything. So it was more just, okay, my depression was what I needed to be focused on. And then I was at CPC, which is the psych center in Buffalo, and they ended up sending me back to Strong because I couldn't continue treatment there because my medical issues had overtaken everything and I couldn't continue. So I think that was when I started to realize that there was a problem, and other people started to realize that it was a problem. I think my support system helped me a lot to recognize that it's not just my depression I'm dealing with here. I need to help myself in different ways.
Well, you hear Marissa talking about her depression, and we're talking about eating disorders, and I want to turn just back to Mary briefly and kind of clarify the point, because sometimes people who don't have eating disorders hear about someone with an eating disorder, and they think either, well, just eat, or that will fix it, or whatever. How often are eating disorders sort of tied to underlying other mental health challenges like depression?
Excellent question, and sadly the answer is a lot. Mm-hmm. So anxiety disorders, mood disorders like depression, or even bipolar illness, substance use disorders, sometimes personality disorders. So I always tell the staff, when there's smoke, look for fire. When you're doing an interview, if there's one of these things, always look for the other. And people don't realize how many comorbid conditions can go along with an eating disorder. I'm just talking about psychiatric behavioral health conditions. I'm not even talking about physical health conditions, because mm-hmm. there's many medical complications that can happen as well. So, yeah, sadly, it's a lot, not just one. And depression, for example, complicates recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Right? It can really bring you down and make recovery harder. So the two things work synergistically in a bad way, right? So it makes it harder. Or if you have OCD, it's going to make it harder to, like, eat at the table if you've got a lot of rituals and rules and you're feeling extra compulsive. It's not impossible, but it's another degree of a burden for the patient.
Well, as Marissa said, she was even surprised herself to end up with an eating disorder because, you know, you had a healthy love for food.
Yeah.
How is your relationship with food now?
That's a good question. I have my days, for sure. I have a weird relationship with food. I still I'm still recovering and I'm strong in my recovery, but I think that in times where I have a little dip in my recovery, I'll then go to the opposite side of the spectrum to kind of prove to myself that I'm still here. So I'll like then overeat, which I didn't. I mean, I had a problem with that before, but it was more to prove to myself that, no, you're fine. Like, you can eat whatever you want, whenever you want, and then it goes downhill even more. So I think that now I have, on a daily basis, I do pretty well with what I eat and how I cope with things. I don't really use food to cope with things as much as I used to. I think it's a little more healthy, but I definitely have those two sides of the spectrum, opposite extreme. I'm really all or nothing.
Well, you kind of touched on this a bit, but I'll ask you the same thing I asked Jen, which is, you know, for all the people who will have friends and loved ones, family members, et cetera, with an eating disorder in the future, and they will be tempted to say something like, well, just eat, or, you know, something similar. You mentioned your own family didn't really believe this until you had kind of a diagnosis, which had to be hard.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to hear that, but I suspect, you know, they loved you and it was just hard to get their heads around. I mean, it's really challenging for family. What's the message? What works for you, or what would be better to hear for you than just eat? You know, what kind of discussion, dialogue, loving outreach is better than that?
I think that what helped me a lot was people coming up to me, like my mom especially. She had emphasized to me that she just wants me to have a healthy life. She just wants me to be able to hang out with my friends like normal and go back to playing sports and not have restrictions. She was like, I want you to live a life that is fulfilling. I know that you can change the world and you're so smart and you're so strong and I know that you can get through everything. I just want you to be able to help yourself do that. And I think that is very helpful and was very powerful for me, that my mom especially, that you need to have people in your life who just tell you that they want you to succeed and that they want you to be able to do it on your own, because you are strong and you are independent and you can be these things. And it's more focusing on, like Jen said, it's more focusing on you as a person, and instead of the disease, because it's a lot of times it's just the disease that's focused on, because we don't focus on ourselves. It's just the disease. So when people focus on you as a person and you, your life and your life path and all you can be, it's very helpful.
Powerful stuff. 30 million people at least in the United States struggle with eating disorders. It crosses all kinds of personal boundaries. I mean, it's not just a narrow, small category. It's a lot of people. You heard Marissa Greer's story. I want to turn to Christopher Fama, who's a graduate student who's in recovery as well. When did it start for you?
Yeah, so I was officially diagnosed in the summer of my freshman year. During my freshman year of high school, I had begun playing sports more as part of varsity teams and junior varsity teams. So I actually took up wrestling from recommendations from my football coach. He said it would assist with tackling and just more of the techniques for football and just improve that overall. So I started wrestling. There's a huge focus on weight and dropping weight classes and just, you know, huge focus on weight, as I said.
Yeah.
So I began dropping weight through recommendations from my coach. We needed people at a lower weight class. I was willing to drop some weight. And so after the wrestling season ended, dropping the weight never stopped for me. It didn't stop until for quite a while, until I was diagnosed in that summer by my pediatrician. So that's when I started receiving treatment, going back off of the behavioral health. So I was diagnosed with depression and anxiety when I was 10. I started receiving treatment back then as well. And that just was amplified by the eating disorder as well. So there, I had this vicious cycle of I would get treatment, be out of the hospital for a month or two at a time, and my anxiety would just get so overwhelming with the thought of gaining weight and trying to eat a normal amount of food, where a suicide attempt would actually occur with me. So it was this vicious cycle of in and out of the hospital pretty much throughout my high school career. My turning point finally came in the summer going into my senior year of high school. My mother and I were applying for colleges together. She was assisting me with that. And just throughout the conversation, she said, I'm not sure if you'd be able to go away for college if you weren't able to get your eating disorder under control. And so that, along with my father had written me a letter of hope and recovery from his perspective. So he talked a lot about how great you are going to be as a social worker, as a father, as just a lot of
what a great letter.
Yeah, definitely. I kept it by my bedside every single day. And every single day that I struggled, I would read that letter.
Nice.
Very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. Just that hope and recovery that I needed because I had so much potential. I'm a smart kid. I'm a very hard worker. I just needed that extra motivation and something to see past my eating disorder. And so I decided that I needed to change my mindset. I was sick and tired of, the cycle of, as I said, of going in and out of treatment. Mm-hmm. I was sick and tired of not being able to, live my life and be able to play sports. And gosh, I wanted to go away to college. So badly.
I feel you, man.
Yeah. So that was my turning point where I just knew I needed to change things. I needed to stop not putting in the effort in my treatment. A lot of times I just kind of walked through the motions of all my treatment episodes and just did the bare minimum. And as soon as I got out, it was the same thing over and over again. A lot of times in treatment, I was very manipulative.
The disease was
manipulated. Yes, absolutely. So my eating disorder told me all these different things that I needed to do in order to beat the system, in mm-hmm. order to get out of the hospital, just so I can go back out and refuel my eating disorder.
And can I ask just a little bit more about that? Because, I was close friends with some wrestlers growing up, mm-hmm. and I don't want to sort of paint with a broad brush. I mean, but certainly if you haven't been in high school wrestling, right. those weight classes, those weigh-ins are intense.
Mm-hmm. Very.
You got to
yep.
meet them. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's all kinds of stories that people have heard about just yes. trying to, that last 12 hours trying to mm-hmm. meet that certain mm-hmm. weight. And I'm not at all alleging that spawns eating disorders. I don't know if there's a relationship. It does seem a little extreme to me. Right. But did you stay in wrestling throughout high school even after you had that disorder?
No.
Okay.
I did the 1 year of wrestling, and that's what set everything off.
Okay. Yep. So it sets it off for you. But then was there something that was in your mind that, so you're not wrestling. Were you scared of something? If you were you not eating much? And were you scared that if I eat too much, something will happen? What was going on?
Right. So growing up pretty much my entire life, I had always been a bigger kid. That's just part of my genes and how I've been made up my whole life. I've always been bigger. I've been bigger boned. I've always had more muscle than most kids my age. And so growing up, I had all these reinforcements of you need to lose weight. Let's try different diets. Let's start drinking skim milk. Stop eating sweets. And that came from a multitude of different people, pediatricians, even family members. Although they didn't know at the time, obviously it was affecting me. And so just that constant reinforcement of my eating disorder, telling myself that, if you do return to eating, you're going to go back to people having to tell you to start mm-hmm. dieting again, and just that another focus on you're overweight. So,
did you avoid when you would go through these bouts? Did you not eat much at all?
Oh no, I definitely did not.
For how long? What would a week look like or a few days look like?
Well, I exercised a ton. So for me, a lot of my huge part of my eating disorder was the over-exercising. So I would, exercise for 4 or 5 hours a day on the elliptical just to feed my eating disorder, restrict my calorie intake, of course. I had a food app that tracked my calories, and I would try to lower it as little as possible. So just a couple of those things. Yeah.
Okay. I'm really moved by the letter and what your parents and your family did for you, because mm-hmm. one of the themes this hour has been trying to understand what we all can do better,
right.
even when it's well-intentioned. It sounds like they were on the money, helping you see.
Absolutely.
We love you, and you've got so much ahead of you. I think that sort of speaks for itself. Anything you want to add to the question of beyond the just eat sort of stuff?
Yeah. So my parents, just throughout their entire time with my eating disorder, they were always stronger than my eating disorder. They never, never, ever gave up on me. No matter how many times I went back into the hospital, no matter how many weeks I went without falling through with treatment recommendations, or no matter how many, how far I had to go for treatment, they always helped me and helped push me to actually get better. And I can't thank them enough for that.
And how is your relationship with food now?
My relationship is really great with food. Since I started my senior year of high school, just trying to reframe my thoughts around food. Just really, really, really trying to implement positive thoughts about food, and just really try to distract my eating disorder from what I'm doing. And I've come a long way with that. So, yeah.
Amazing story.
Yeah.
Thanks, by the way, for being willing to share that.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's going to hit people. I mean, it's just a really powerful hour. Some questions for Mary that have come from some listeners. And before I even jump into those, you know, Christopher's talking about growing up and hearing a lot about, well, you know, a healthy diet is this. And I want to ask you about striking a balance that we have as parents and as society, because we do want people to eat healthy foods. We want people to have good relationships with food, but we don't want people to sort of punish themselves so severely or to be kind of wrapped with fear about food. How do you strike a balance, especially when you're raising kids, to raise them to say, hey, look, input, you know, the food is an input, and there's consequences, but at the same time, I want you to have a healthy relationship with that.
So this is going to sound really old-fashioned. The word would be moderation. I really, everyone has their take on how to, quote, eat healthy. My concern about the healthy, as it's defined now, is closer to orthorexia, which is having an eating disorder but eating too healthy. So you eat 3 bags of carrots during the day, you have a smoothie, like that can go into a bad habit too. So I would say moderation, and food should be a source of joy and comfort and just fuel. Like, it would be a lie to say that people don't have comfort foods. We do. And there's actually nothing wrong with it. Where it goes awry is if we have anxiety, perfectionism, lots of other potential traits, and lots of environmental stressors that turn on vulnerable genes mm-hmm. that bring that to the extreme, kind of like Marissa was saying. It's easy mm-hmm. to go to an extreme overeating or undereating, but it's not happening because of one thing. So even if you, this is going to sound, it isn't helpful when we don't teach our kids to do moderation, but that in and of itself is not enough to create an eating disorder, because our culture, sadly, doesn't understand moderation. So it's kind of a biopsychosocial cultural recipe for disaster. There's many things coming together that create an eating disorder. So genes and environment together. But I would say moderation. I can't turn to a book and go, this is what you should follow. Except sure. The closest thing I can come to is Ellen Sater's work on how to feed children, mm-hmm. because I love her, how she just talks about it.
All right, so a couple phone calls from people with comments off air. First of all, Assemblyman Mark Johns called the program, and we always appreciate hearing from the Assemblyman. He couldn't stay on the line but wanted to say he wants everyone to know that there's a bill in the Assembly that passed this week to have eating disorders covered by insurance. It's waiting to pass the New York State Senate, and Mark says without adequate care and follow-up, you can have even bigger, more expensive problems later. And he suggested you might be able to tell us a little bit more about this.
Thank you, Assemblyman Johns. He's a huge champion. There are so many legislators in town who are amazingly supportive. Yes, because up until recently, only anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa were included in the state language about insurance. And we'd like to expand that to all DSM-5, that's the psychiatric Bible, categories. So whether you have bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder, or some pure mutation, which is called OSFED, other specified eating disorders, everyone is struggling. And we shouldn't just look at an eating disorder as anorexia or bulimia, okay? And I want to add something, too. The other thing that listeners should know is not only should you contact your legislator about this, but also the Western New York Center. We're asking the governor and the legislator to continue funding the Western New York work. So while you're at it, ask for level funding for Western New York Comprehensive Care Center and have this other bill that Assemblyman Johns just talked about, widening to all diagnostic categories, the insurance reimbursement.
All right, Assemblyman Johns, thank you for that. Kelly called in to say, says her daughter has an eating disorder, and her husband and she try to help her daughter with, along with the recommendations from counselors. But Kelly says, my daughter doesn't really want us to be part of that process. She gets upset when we try to be involved and help her. She says she's a young adult, and what should we do? She wants to be supportive, but it seems like when she tries to be supportive, she gets pushed farther away.
So I'm going to also turn to our folks with lived experience to hear what they have to say. But I am a pretty staunch person on getting parents and families involved. Mm-hmm. An eating disorder, especially if you live with your family, you can't do it alone. The eating disorder is going to tell you that you can do it alone and you should. So as a mom or a dad, I would say kind of like what Chris and Jen and Marissa have said, I would approach your young adult and say, look, I love you. I'm scared that this illness is going to try to take over your life, and you're brilliant and you're beautiful and you're creative, and I want to do whatever I can. I don't mean to be intrusive. I come from a place of love, and I want to reinforce whatever your therapist is asking you to do, so we're all working in concert. But I guess I would turn to you guys and ask you, like, how would you handle that with this young lady who's...
You know... Oh, I'm sorry, Marissa.
No,
do
you're fine.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree with Mary, and I know from my own experience, I was really, as a young adult, anxious about pulling my family in for a variety of reasons, which this young girl may be experiencing. Some, I didn't want any more people on board to fight the eating disorder when I was first in recovery. I didn't want to face that I disappointed my family.
Right.
There were a lot of untruths. And I was pushed and pushed and pushed to bring my family in. And it was the best thing to happen. The love of my parents and hearing them articulate it and having a therapeutic place for the people that loved me to be my mirror when I couldn't see what they saw, sort of like Chris said, you know, my parents did the same thing with helping me see who they saw and reminding me that person is still in there. And only my family could do that for me at the time. So I would tell Kelly to stay firm and know that really the resistance is coming from the eating disorder
yes.
and not her daughter.
Yeah, I think it's important to, that is very important that you're targeting your daughter. You want your daughter to be the one who is succeeding. And unfortunately, so often parents do listen and they do push back and they're like, okay, like you can handle this on your own, which we can't. Honestly, the harsh truth is that if you're not recovering, you are dying. And you can't do it on your own. There are people everywhere like that are telling you, oh my gosh, you're losing so much weight, you look so great, or like just people that just don't understand. You need people on your side to help you fight this. It's very hard to cope with the fact that maybe your daughter might be mad with you for a while, and that's okay because you're helping save her life.
And Christopher, you know, for families that have struggles with speaking about emotional or difficult things, drawing on your story, maybe an actual letter.
Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe a way to say, I want to say all the things to you, and I want to share love with you, and we don't have to interrupt each other, and I want you to hold on to this and never forget this, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Just sharing that message of recovery and all these positive things that you have potential for as well. So,
and also I just want to add to that when you're an adolescent or a young adult, you're already developmentally at a place where you're supposed to stand on your own two feet. But that's kind of bogus in our culture anyway. We are should be interdependent. So when you hold out both realities, I know that you want to be autonomous and you want to be independent, and that's important. I want to support that. And at the same time, the eating disorder is actually taking that away from you. You hold out both realities.
Before you lose your life physically, you lose your life mentally to this disorder, and that is so much more important. I think people need to realize that it's not, it takes everything from you, and you need people to support you.
I want to say before the hour's out, we mentioned off the top, this is, these disorders affect everybody, and if the media presents it as sort of a, you know, the white teenage girl thing, a whole other conversation is the LGBTQ plus population. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and when you look at statistics, gay males are thought to represent roughly 5% of the total male population, but among males who have eating disorders, 42% mm-hmm. Identify as gay. Mm-hmm. And it's a real challenge in the LGBTQ plus population. Just some quick thoughts about that as well, Mary.
Well, the gay culture, when you talk to gay men, for example, you're supposed to be svelte. You're supposed to be lean, and probably you're supposed to be muscular at the same time. I don't know how you pull all that off. So that culture itself can be kind of stressful. And then there's all kinds of isms. Heterosexism, there's violence, people come out and people don't support you. So there's other reasons for why people are traumatized, microaggression. So in that situation, all those things come together.
Well, I know there's people like Mary Tantillo from the Healing Connection, and Mary is also with the Western New York Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. How to get in contact if people need you?
Do you want me to give everybody's laughing and going, her cell phone.
Online.
Everybody.
They all have your cell phone.
Online. If you, I'm just trying to think of which www.ny@eatingdisorders.org. That's our Western New York site. 276-1602, I think, is my care manager's number.
You'll find her online. Healing Connection, Comprehensive Care Center for Eating Disorders. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
And Jennifer, Christopher, and Marissa, continued good health and success.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rob, Megan. I'm Evan. Have a great weekend.